Welcome to the show for sinners and sufferers. My name is Cody, and I'm joined today by pastor and friend Trevor Rysavy. Trevor, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Cody. Just off of sickness, so I feel like I'm myself again.
Well, that's good. I've been on like the verge where I feel like my voice goes and then it comes back and then it goes and it comes back. So we'll see if we get through a whole episode with my voice. But if you need to just do all the talking, you can do that. But for anyone who maybe this is the first episode you've clicked on, we've had Trevor on a few times. So I don't want to go too into detail. You can go back about a year ago, actually, was the first episode we did where you kind of introduced me to the idea of post-millennial eschatology. It's an end times view that is pretty different from kind of the most mainstream in the West, but not new. It's very historical, and it was one that I think I always dismissed as not being super biblical or rational. And then you kind of sat me down and made me realize that I didn't believe anything biblical or rational, and it made me rethink the whole thing. And I think that's your ability to do that is beneficial for people, even if we don't ultimately end up agreeing with you. I think the way that you can make us think is really good. And I wanted to bring Trev back on mainly just because I like talking to him, but also thought it could be beneficial with the way I see Pastor Trev interact with people, especially with, I guess, people about your kids' age would be how it is with young adults. The way you kind of mentor and teach, I think, is really inspiring and aligns with my goal for this channel. And I think in this moment in time, historically, I see a lot going on. Like when I open TikTok, and part of it's that it knows who I am and it knows what's going to get me to, like, in the rabbit hole. But I see all these videos of my peers and younger, like 20s and 30 year olds, people kind of despairing at the world and despairing at, you know, the economy and the housing market. They're like, you know, I'll probably never own a house unless our economy crashes. So it's like, do I want the economy to crash? Maybe. And it's and then, you know, we have world leaders that are constantly, like, most of the most powerful world leaders right now are all kind of making fools of themselves and constantly in scandals and controversy. And then I hear from leaders all the time that they think the church is in decline. And, you know, younger generations are leaving the church. The church is mostly filled with gray hairs. And then on kind of on top of it is where I'll start is then now suddenly there's a war, a renewed war, I guess, is kind of always happening in the Middle East. And you have a lot of Christian leaders double down on this, like, yep, this is the end, you know. Time for the church to get in our bunkers and get our cans of beans and just be prepared for everything to be terrible and just ride this out until Jesus rescues us. And I think it'd be really easy in light of everything for a person to just feel hopeless and feel despair. And I'm hoping, because I see you as someone who has a lot of hope, and you see a lot of hope in the things that are going on. And I thought hopefully our conversation can kind of go that direction. We can help others to see that hope as well. But I wanted to throw it to you right up front. So I just did an episode with Matthew on Israel. Like, what is it? How does it fit into the Christian framework? How does Israel fit into the narrative of redemption of God saving his people? And I just want to pose it to you from your perspective. Does Israel, the nation, have any specific significance in the outworking of things in end times or eschatology? Is Israel still significant specifically?
Yeah, it's a it's a good question, I think, to be asking. And I don't think, if you've read your Bible at all, I really don't think it's possible to be kind of ignorant of this idea that one way or another, this could potentially be significant. And I think the reality is Israel has always been significant in one sense, as that this is the original people of God that was chosen, called out of Abraham. And throughout the Old Testament, the perspective of the Bible is always told through the eyes of Israel. And so, yes, Israel is significant in everything. However, you do have the book of Galatians, the book of Hebrews, and a few other books that describe the church as being grafted into the concept of Israel. In fact, I was just relearning some things and going over some things before this, that in the Old Testament, they actually use the word ecclesia to describe Israel. But then Paul uses the word ecclesia to describe the church has gathered in Galatia that's made up of Jews and Gentiles. So there's actually, even in the biblical writers, there's no longer the kind of distinction that we thought of previously in terms of ethnicity exclusively. And so you do have the importance of Israel, but you have it actually reshaped in some ways, not replaced, but reshaped and re-understood. And so I think that's an important thing to understand, that when the Bible described Israel, it never described the land definitions as we might understand it. It never understood Israel as something that had a citizenship where, you know, if you were born there, you were automatically a citizen inside of it. And so a good example is, let's say you come from Thailand, but you're born in Canada. Your citizenship is automatically in Canada. Your ethnicity is actually something a little bit separate. And so I think one of the problems that we have when discussing Israel is we never understand what is actually happening when we describe the word Israel. Are we describing someone who's born in that nation? Or are we describing someone who's Jewish? Because technically, you could not be Jewish, but be born in Israel. So I know a friend of mine who is Ukrainian, but his ethnicity is Ukrainian, but he's born in Israel. Well, what is that? Well, this is why I think we need to be a little more careful about how we understand that Israel was never described as exclusively land in the Bible. Mm-hmm. It was always described as the land of Israel, the people. And so when Israel was exiled in Babylon, they were still called Israel. The land wasn't called Israel. They were called Israel as a people. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't kind of understand that, I think there's always going to be some sort of confusion as to how does Israel fit in eschatologically. Well, what do you mean by that word? Do you mean the people within the land? Do you mean Jewish people? Do you mean the people that God called? Do you mean like the actual man, Israel, who is... Most people don't even know that Israel was named after a man.
Yeah.
Whose, you know, name was Jacob. So, I mean, you can't have those kind of discussions without that. And so I think some of the stuff of Israel that we're talking about that becomes fear-mongering ends up just being a lack of understanding the basic terms of discussion of what we're actually talking about. So once you kind of get that, and you say that, well, the recent conflict with the Middle East, was it with Jewish people or is it with two nations? And so I would argue it is not with a people group, it's with two nations. Mm-hmm. While some might argue, you know, Palestinians aren't necessarily a nation, but more of a people group. But I was like, it's two people groups having kind of issues. It is not quite exactly just like the Israel of the Bible and then the Israel nation of today. They're not synonymous with each other, in my opinion, no matter how you look at it. So some of that, I don't know that fully answers your question, but it takes away some of the technicalities. Like, eschatology isn't was never designed as a plug and play sort of thing where you just insert all the proper codes and then all of a sudden the understanding comes. And so Israel gets plugged in here and Gaza gets, you know, plugged in here and the Palestinians get plugged in here and blah, blah, blah. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden all this eschatological understanding comes true. No, I don't think that at all. And so therefore I'm not really terrified. But the other side I would say is eschatologically, no matter which side you're on, Jesus says, you're going to hear wars and rumor of wars, but the end is not yet. Mm-hmm. This isn't the indication of the end. So it doesn't even matter where you come in on that. If you come in on the dispensational or premillennial or postmillennial or amillennial, the truth is, Jesus says, if there's going to be wars, that wasn't the indication of it. So I just don't know how you can make a case that because of the present conflict, now is the actual end. No, it doesn't make sense to me at all.
That is an interesting point, and it's one of those passages that when you try to read it as much as you can without external influence, without bias, yeah, when you read, you know, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars and these things, does the phrasing does even say like don't worry or something?
Yeah,
like,
it does.
But he's like, do not fear. That is not the end.
That's not the end.
And then we just fill in from based on our other things that have influenced our understanding. Oh well, the wars and rumors of wars are not the end yet. The end is then when there's even more wars and it's even worse, or is the end then peace because there's no more wars and rumors of wars? And I guess that's a kind of a dividing line in the views is if wars and rumors of wars isn't the end, is the end even more wars, or is it the absence of wars?
Well, again, my take on that passage is that was describing what was going to happen in AD 70 anyways. So mm-hmm. in some ways it's a moot point, but if I try to take the perspective of this is still going to talk about the future that we have not yet experienced, I would say that it says these are but the beginning of the birth pains. And so I just don't know how you kind of make a case that what's happening right now, like a conflict. And by the way, we're hearing about the conflict and the conflict is pretty bad right now, but it's not like this is a brand new conflict. It's been happening for quite some time. So I don't know where you begin, like just because they don't like each other now does not mean that you don't have a long history of conflict. And so where does that start? And this is where it gets so technical. I'm like, I just don't understand how this particular conflict is the one that's actually kicking off the end times. Like you could have said that about any conflict in the last, and you know what, many people in terms of eschatology have been trying to do that. They were like, okay, you know, Israel became a nation in 1948. And so a generation later, as the Bible says, we're going to see this. And then that generation came and went. And then we said, oh, maybe it's two generations. And then two generations came and went. And we're almost hitting a third generation. And now some are saying, oh, it's going to be 100 years within that nation Israel becoming a nation in 1948. So technically we'll have till 2048 to see, but my guess is 2048 will come and go, and then what? Then what will we say? Mm-hmm. We keep trying to predict this. We keep saying it's kicking off the end, and the end doesn't keep coming. And actually, so far, I'm right.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so far, everyone who says Jesus isn't going to come yet has been right. And those who have said Jesus is coming soon have been wrong.
Yeah. So I've thought it's somewhat ironic that the kind of the majority of end times ideas or eschatological frameworks are all saying Jesus could return any minute, but then also have like a whole checklist they've discovered of things that have to happen first. And somehow don't see those as contradictory. It was like Jesus could return any minute as long as a third temple is built on the Dome of the Rock, right. And it, or Jesus is going to come any minute so long or as soon as all the nations are Christianized to take a stab the other direction. But it is kind of funny that you have these almost conflicting ideas that it's like we invent checklists for ourselves that we believe have to pass before Jesus mm-hmm. can return, whereas the only like the most definite thing we have from Jesus is that nobody knows and that we're going to be surprised.
Yeah. And so that's just it. You know, I think every single generation outside or after Jesus's ascension basically thought it's going to happen within my generation. Like I'm pretty sure mm-hmm. every single generation, every single century had somebody who was very convinced. I mean, Martin Luther was very convinced Jesus was coming back within a couple of years because of what happened in the Reformation and so on. And it actually seemed to intensify. And then in the early 1900s, it just seemed like that increased where there's more and more and more people. And then back, you know, in the 80s, particularly 1988 was a big deal. Like 1988, how many years ago is that now? 40? Yeah. Like 40 years ago, they were saying 1988 is the year. Like a full generation after a generation. And we're not getting it right. And I'm just, in some ways, I'm pragmatically losing my faith. Even if they could be right, I'm like, but the chances seem so low based upon past history. But the other side of that is, you know, what it's doing to people is harmful in some ways, and so I'm starting to see a bit of a harm that it's probably one of the reasons why I'm willing to push back on some people a little bit is there's actually kind of a harm to this very escapist emphasis. Mm-hmm. That discourages people. And one of the things that I've discovered in my journey of eschatology is that I am absolutely convinced if your eschatology scares you or makes you afraid, you don't have correct eschatology. It doesn't really matter what it is, but if it scares you, it's not correct because there's no evidence biblically across the board of eschatology being something that scared people into believing in God. There's nothing like that in the scriptures. Every time that actually some of the clearest eschatological words come is in places like Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah, and Revelation. And all four of those places were prophetic ministries to people in dire straits to give them hope every single time. And so if your eschatology excites you and makes you long for good days, but brings you great hope, you probably have a good grasp of this. So that's why I say if what's happening in Israel makes you afraid, then I'm like, but I don't think you're seeing it right. Maybe if it kickstarts some things, there's a bit of excitement there, but there should also be like you know, anyone that's for any reason excited about what's going on between the Palestinians and the Israelis should rethink how they think about that. Mm-hmm. Like you should never be excited that someone's engaged in war. Like,
yeah,
that doesn't feel at all like God's heart. In fact, it's the opposite. God's like, if you think I enjoy disciplining you, no, you're misunderstanding this. You need to understand that it is difficult for him to discipline his people. Even if he does, and even if it's difficult, I think God does not take pleasure in people's suffering. Not at all. It's probably the hardest part of God being God, is his steely will that pursues his discipline amongst his people in spite of the fact that it can cause tremendous suffering. I think he can only do it because he has in mind something that's much better for them and that they will understand at some point. But so that's the other thing I would say is, you know, we shouldn't get excited about what's going on in Israel because it's there's some terrible suffering. But we shouldn't get excited about any war. We shouldn't get excited about any suffering in the world. Again, I know that's a little bit off topic for you, Cody, but that's a little bit of how I feel about what's going on there right now.
Yeah, no worries. You might have rearranged my further questions just based on that. So sorry if I throw you for a loop.
No, that's fine.
I was trying to look up a passage, but I made my computer ding really loud, which now I'm going to have to cut out of the audio, so I'm going to stop looking it up. But you made me think of a point. You said we have this tendency towards kind of an escapist theology, and I've used the term defeatist, that it's like we anticipate loss, and I know it was, I think it was within the last year, there was a John MacArthur clip that went semi-viral where he's kind of pushing back on amillennials and postmillennials. And he says, we lose down here. He says, they killed the apostles. They killed Jesus. They're going to kill us. And I think for me, the first red flag was that them killing Jesus wasn't actually Jesus losing. That was the victory, which I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt that he would acknowledge that if you put him on the spot, that he just kind of misspoke there. But I do see, especially like one of the questions I wanted to ask you about it is the church. And you hear lots of people talk about the church being in decline. And the passage I was trying to look up, because I wanted to read it, and maybe you'll know what I'm referring to. But in that similar discourse, I believe it's an Olivet discourse, he talks about an apostasy. I don't think he uses the word, but we interpret it as an apostasy, as people leaving and wandering away from the faith. And kind of probably the majority of people I talk to who are really on about this apostasy and being watchful for it take that as it seems like the church is doing well, but then everyone leaves and then that's the end, and the church just really is frail and withered and tiny by the time that Jesus comes in to judge. But I see it as, and this is where I was trying to find the phrasing, is he then speaks of going forth to preach right after speaking of the apostasy. And I see similar language in Timothy when he talks about, for you've heard it said that many would wander away in this time. And then he immediately exhorts preaching. So is the, I guess, do you think the great apostasy is, assuming it's a thing, maybe you don't think it's a thing, but assuming it's to come and not something that's already happened, maybe I'll phrase that as a question. Do you think it's something coming or something that's happened? But then also, do you see that as an end, or do you see it as a bump, like something to overcome? Yeah, boy,
that's a good question. I would say, I think apostasy is always happening. Here's maybe, like, this will sound amillennial in some ways. I don't want to over spiritualize it, but I would say there's always instances of apostasy. What constitutes great apostasy? I don't know. That seems to be missing from this. So what's your definition of lots of apostasy? And who's gathering these statistics? So in some ways, this is a straw man. If you say the church is in decline, and I would say, okay, show me how it's in decline. Your answer can't be, well, it is. Like, okay, that could be your perspective. But then what do you mean by apostasy? Do you mean true churches are becoming apostate? I doubt it. But you know, to go back to you said kind of we lose down here. Well, what's your definition of losing? Like, I, I'm saying the Bible clearly says martyrdom looks like losing, but it's not.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's not an easy answer out, but it's just say, what's your definition of losing? If you think losing is we have more people, yeah, you might be able to make a case. There's not as many people in a church service. You could make a case for that. However, if we use a metaphor, and a good one is pruning a tree. So a good example, in my front yard, my landlord decides to cut down this apple tree because it's too big. He did not want to produce more fruit. That wasn't his intention. His intention was, let's get rid of this gangly tree in the front yard of our house. Let's make it a little more manageable and let's pare it back a bit. And so he did. He cut it right down almost to the point of it dying. Now this year we got big, red, juicy apples that I thought only grew in BC.
Yeah.
So did the tree decline? Well, if you looked at last year in the fall when he cut it, yes. If you look at it now, this fall, no, it grew. So that's the problem with saying it's declined. In comparison to what? Over the whole world? No, the church is not declining over the whole world. There are 2 billion Christians. I'm not that good at math, but that's 20% of the present population of the world is Christian. That's not a dying religion. It's not declining. Now, is everyone like high volume Christian? I don't know. That's a difficult thing to put your hand on. But one thing I know for sure is you can't just say a blanket statement like the church is in decline or things are going badly or we're losing without kind of going like, well, what part of it are you looking at? Are you looking at over the history of 2,000 years? Like, I'm pretty sure this thing started with 12 people. And right now, living today, we got 20, you know, 2 billion. So that's not a decline as far as I know.
Mm.
And that's not even including those who have died in the faith. So how are you defining decline? Like your local church? Did your local church gathering go from 70 to 40? Yeah, that's decline. Did the Canadian church in general? In some ways, yes. But in other ways, I would say, but the gospel was getting lost somewhere. And so what happened was people that weren't actually Christians just quit pretending. That's not necessarily decline. That's a little bit of pruning. But to go back to my, you know, statement about the apple tree, that actually is the way God gets growth going. So the reality is, if you look carefully at the pattern of history, what you see is every time there's pruning or discipline or persecution, the church grows. Every single time. It never fails. This is the way. So losing is something that needs to be redefined a little bit. Like, which part? Are you in that small window of heavy persecution? I guess you could make the case for losing or decline or whatever, but if you start broadening and looking a little bit more at church history, I think you can't make the case anymore that ultimately that is losing. It's actually growing.
Yeah. I wonder if a lot of leaders and people who are saying these things are really just mourning the decline of cultural Christianity.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And that's something too that, so when, you know, because I've done this where I still want to plant a church someday. People have been on the show for a long time know that when we started this, I was planning a church and it didn't work. And whenever I talk to people, they're like, well, you know, churches are struggling. There's no point planning. The church is in decline. Churches are struggling. And my personality is to go, they're struggling. Okay, let's double down and go harder rather than like, oh no, they're struggling. I guess we'll stop planning churches.
Right.
But it just reminded me, too, of when I was just a little immature Bible college student. We were learning about I think it's called the gravedigger hypothesis. It's this idea that the Reformation was ultimately destructive And in part, I guess, to the unity of the church, maybe you could make that case. But they're like, look at how much influence the church had and how influential the church was. I was like, yeah, but also you had a loss of the gospel, some terrible theology, like basically an abusive structure calling itself the church. And you're in a situation where people just assume they're Christian because they exist. Like, they're like, I'm right. born. And they're like, well, yeah, I live in England. Of course I'm a Christian.
Right.
And have, like, losing that cultural Christianity and losing that massive cultural force that called itself the church, actually, I think ultimately was a good thing. And and I suspect, and I've said, even in the midst of those first, like, year of COVID lockdowns, I think this is going to be a good thing, ultimately, for the church. Because, you know, you like you're a pastor, and I've been a pastor for a fraction of the time that you have, but you spend a lot of time trying to, like, please people who doesn't sound very pastoral, but who are essentially dead weight, like people who aren't actually part of the church, aren't part of the fellowship, that they're just there to make noise. And a lot of those people, it seems like, are leaving when it becomes less cool and less beneficial to be part of that community.
Right. And I think it's difficult to get into a, you know, I don't want to get too hung up on this idea that I know the difference between who's in and who's out in the church. But the church has always been described as the church visible and the church invisible. And I think there's an aspect of this that, if it's invisible, that means you can't really see it or understand the boundaries of it. And so don't put a lot of time and effort into, is this person, like, truly in? Were they in? Were they not in? And more into, like Jesus said, treat them according to their fruit. You will see them according to their fruit. And that's what you're supposed to do. And His Holy Spirit is the one that can see right into someone's heart anyways. It's not really our job. It's not only not our job, we're not capable of it. We're not actually capable of seeing into someone's soul and seeing if they really truly believe.
Yeah.
So why are we spending so much time trying to figure out the boundaries of this? That's part of this whole eschatological thing of, like, if we really don't ultimately know, even though we can see some signs and be like, oh yeah, besides that, I mean, my last argument to that is the instructions are to flee to the region of Judea.
Yeah.
If we see the signs, if we're going to take that at kind of face value. So I don't know if WestJet started to fly to Judea or not, but as far as I've checked, I think it's only London and other places. But that's tongue in cheek. That's an easy pot shot at maybe the other perspective.
Yeah. What? So I'll wrap. I've got two more questions for you, but I'll wrap them kind of into one. I'll say, like, from your perspective, then, what do you think is next on the eschatological timeline? And within that, like, what do you think it's worth, you know, planning churches, getting, like, going to school for 4 years, bringing children into this world, like in light of a lot of people saying, like, you know, get in your bunker, start eating beans, like. What do you think is next, and is that reality?
Yeah, good. It's a good question. I got a quick practical response. Is that 2 Peter actually talks about this, and I think the book of 2 Peter is way more helpful than we might think on this. And that is, number one, if you think that it's nearing the end and the proper response is to bunker and see if you can escape with your faith, that looks very frowned upon, first of all, with Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, where he says, yeah, you might get in, but it's by the skin of your teeth, and you don't really want that. But 2 Peter talks about this idea that if you think the proper response to Jesus' imminent return is to get away from people who need Jesus, then you clearly don't have the heart of God. Hmm. And this is why I think 2 Peter is written to people who are asking this question, why is God dragging his feet? And it's actually, in my mind, if you're not interested in planting churches, how could you possibly say that's the heart of God? Like, is it, do you see anywhere in scripture where God is like, good grief, if I can just get through these 1,000 years and finally get to the end of this thing, then I can finally have the people of God as I want them? Or do you find a long-suffering God, a patient God? And so 2 Peter talks about, Peter says, if you try to understand God's timing in terms of your timing, you're going to get mixed up because 1,000 years are as one day and one day is as 1,000 years. That's not to try to mess with the minds of those who are thinking through the millennium. That's to say God doesn't think about time the way you do. And he's not impatient like you do. And impatient people are people that think their time matters more than anyone else. And so I would say, if you're sitting there waiting for Jesus to come back and you're deciding not to invest in ministry, not to plant churches because Jesus might return soon, then I would say, so you don't care about anyone in your neighborhood? Like, those people of all people should be planting churches at a rapid pace, doing everything they possibly can to warn people, not just to warn people, but to persuade people of the good news of Jesus Christ. There is no category in the New Testament for those who believe of the imminent return in Jesus Christ to sit on their thumbs. It's not there. But in 2 Peter, Peter reminds his friends that he's never met of this question, and he says, God doesn't think about time the way you do. It may look to you like he's dragging his heels on certain things, but he is patient to bring about his final day, the coming ultimate capital D day of the Lord, because he wants as many people as possible to repent. That is actually the heart of God. So that's why I was like, I don't know how you could possibly gather from the fact that if you believe that Jesus is going to return in the next 2 years, then you shouldn't quit your job and get away from other people. You should do everything you can to plant churches and share the gospel with people. Everything you possibly can. Now, I don't necessarily believe that Jesus has in his mind to return in 2 years, but I'm certainly open to the idea, warm to it. Of course I am. But what happens is, I think Jesus in Matthew 25 in particular, just after he talks about all of the end things, he says, you know, your initial response to all of this is when and how long? And Jesus tells two parables in particular that says, wrong questions. Your questions would be, am I ready and am I faithful? Yeah. So actually, it's not really of your concern. If you understand eschatology, you've got two faithful responses, to be faithful and to be ready. Those are it. So both sides should plant churches. Do you see my argument there? It doesn't matter on which side of this you fall. The right response is you should always be thinking about more people repenting, which is what church planting ends up being. But because I don't feel that there's this enormous pressure of Jesus returning in the next few months, I think I have the opportunity to think a little bit more healthily about the longevity of training leaders. You don't have to rush to put in people that are unqualified anymore. And so I think I actually just talked to this about someone to today. So when some people hear the word urgent, they make that word synonymous with panic, and they are not synonymous. So you can be urgent, meaning this is really important and I need to do this. And you can be panic, like, oh my goodness, what do I do? And there's no category for the person who's panicking. Like That's why you have, I think, Matthew 25. You're going to see wars. You're going to see rumors of wars. You're going to see all kinds of conflict. Don't worry. Don't panic. Right? Like when Jesus comes, he does not bring this essence of, he brings a panacea, do not fear. He sends angels specifically for that purpose to say, don't fear. Don't fear. Don't fear. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid. I'm here. I'm here. I've got this. And so that's why I think it doesn't really matter to me what aspect, what conviction you hold on those parts of eschatology. It doesn't change, you know, should I bring kids into this world? Can you? You should. Mm. Right? Should I get married? Yeah, of course you should. Should you go on a missions trip? Yep. Should you sell all your goods and, you know, your house? Well, is it a good time to do that? Mm. You should be ready for Jesus at any time, and yet you should be perfectly comfortable with 70 years, 100 years, 150 years from now. No, it shouldn't change anything that you do.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I like when you get passionate enough, you start slapping your microphone. That's you know, it's that's how you so know sorry. It's good stuff.
Sorry.
But I want to kind of a final question to allow you to, I guess, give some closing remarks is I just wanted to ask you what sort of wisdom or advice or how would you encourage younger Christians who are maybe tempted to despair, who are looking at the economy and looking at government and looking at wars going on and hearing these things and are just like finding it hard to have hope. What would you say to those people?
Right. It's good. My advice would be to look to the places in Scripture where the letter was written to people who were in a similar situation to you. Mm-hmm. So where, for instance, one of the best places you can go is to books of the Bible where the prophets are speaking to those who are currently in exile, because that was a pretty dark place. What kind of things did they hear? Well, they heard God wins in the end. God's kingdom will reign. I would say turn to the Psalms, where you see actually the whole trajectory of David, who starts maybe in despair, but doesn't end in despair. Because he has kind of vocalized his despair. But as he vocalized his despair, he also vocalizes God's answers to his despair, the things that he knows to be true and that he's heard before. And he ends in a, I guess I will wait patiently for you to get there. So look for the context in the Bible where you know that the letters and the books are written to people who actually hold a lot in common with you. Mm. I mean, ultimately, I would say this is where you don't have to be afraid of eschatology, which I was, excuse me, for a good portion of my life, that good eschatology leads to a long perspective, the long haul perspective that allows you to weather the small storms of suffering that come into your life. Mm. So to use an example, I have a financial investor friend who told me that when you look at the history of investing money, there is no one who has invested money over a 25-year period consistently that's ever lost money. Hmm. And it's a good, but there are examples of people that only invested for 3 or 4 years and then kind of removed their money at a bad time and lost money.
Yeah.
In other words, if you take the approach in financial investing, I'm not going to invest just this year. I'm going to invest for at least the next 25 years. That there is no, I mean, they've only been recording kind of the history of investments. And I'm not an expert. I'm not telling you to invest your money necessarily or what funds. But I'm saying that principle is really interesting. Meaning, like, if you think of your in terms of maybe God only gives you 40 years, maybe God only gives you 30 years in your life. But if you plan to invest in the kingdom of God as though you'll be here for 75 or 80 years, you'll never lose, because you'll be patient with those who need patience. You won't rush things that don't need to be rushed. You won't give up on a church plant too early because you need stuff right away, right? You won't have the same metrics towards success that some of people in our culture, like most of the things in our culture, are trying to lead us toward get success, and you need success immediately. But I mean, if you don't have to, like, if you don't have to show your metrics until the end of your life, man, you can make them look pretty good. Yeah. Right? Okay, maybe that one day is bad, but over the course of 30 years, you generally are, have this kind of rate of success. So yeah. I think that long-term view, whatever you need to do to garnish that long-term view, and I believe that can come with some good hard looks at eschatology. I think I would encourage many people to read church history, and all you need to do is read a little bit of church history and you'll find there's a lot of things that we've seen before that maybe look a little bit different, but essentially are the same sorts of things. And so church history is another way to gain that long-term view. Like, this has happened before and this is how people have responded.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even with the housing crisis and the interest rates, one of the things that people are pointing to is this comes and goes. We've seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
So don't worry. I don't need to sell my house like right today. I don't need to buy a house right today, because this will level out probably, because that's what we've seen in history. But if you only have the last 2 or 3 years as your experience, and that includes COVID, you're going to be terrified, right? Mm. And so I think that's the advice I would give, is whatever you need to do biblically, spiritually, to take a longer view toward things will actually level out a lot of these things naturally.
Hmm. That's good. I just want to put in that we are not qualified to give any financial advice.
No.
We accept no liability.
No.
But in line with the giving poor advice, it's funny, is you just reminded me, is one of the little stories I like to give to youth group kids all the time is I learned that at the end of high school, I was never like an honor student or anything, not dean's list in college, any of that stuff. But I started, if I felt I was failing a class, I'd just withdraw from it because I didn't feel like it was worth spending my time doing something that I wasn't worthwhile anyways. And I didn't know until I had already like walked and done everything for my grad that withdrawn courses don't show on your final transcript, and I graduated with high honors. So more bad advice, but I just think it's funny. That's like, yeah, in the short term I'm like, oh, I withdrew from a class again, no honors for me. And then at the graduation they're like, here's your shiny paper. I was like, okay. But anyways, I appreciate you coming on, Trev. Yeah, I appreciate your perspective and your heart for people and for the church, and encourage people. I hopefully will have you on again. And I'm also still looking forward to you starting your own podcast. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you have that up and running, I'll be sending people your way. But for everyone listening, especially those who stay to the end, we always appreciate you the most. Don't tell the people that left early, but you're better than them. And we'd love to hear from you. You can leave comments on YouTube or send a message on Instagram at Sinner Sufferers, or join the Discord. There's links on sinnersandsufferers.com. And if you want to say something to Trev, message me and I will try to get you in contact, because he doesn't do socials. So. But
that's right. Yeah, anyways. You need to take the long term on that. Long-term view on getting a podcast off the ground, or my interaction on social media.
right? But we'll make it happen. Anyways, thanks for listening. I'll see you another time.